Hello and welcome to LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard. I am here today with Josh Olsiewicz. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Brian. How's it going?
It's going well, man. We got the dip. We had a podcast 2 weeks ago saying where to buy the dip, and now the question is, Josh, did you buy the dip?
I did, in fact, buy the dip. My bids were just hanging out there waiting to be hit.
Waiting to be filled.
At least for BTC. I don't think my ETH bids were a little lower, I think, but still optimistic that they'll be hit.
Don't speak ill of Ethereum such a way.
Oh.
Well, good for you. I was I made out okay, but I had to trade my way out of it a little bit on the first leg of the dip. And now I am positioned in a way that I do not want a retest. But it does look like it certainly could, although you know what, it's always tougher. It's tougher to buy the dip than anyone wants to tell you, isn't it? Like, the dip came because Legacy had two horrible days in a row, or one and a half, because the afternoon weekly save crew came in hard, plunge protection team on Legacy. So the question is what happens Monday, but I feel pretty okay about crypto between like now and Sunday night.
Yeah, it felt like a multi-asset risk off situation. Yeah. Gold,
just a get S&P. Out of here scenario. It was a bullish VIX scenario is what it was.
Yeah, and so a few things, obviously, with DeFi insanity, transaction fee Ethereum insanity, VIX was quietly spiking a few days before that big move.
Yeah, the VIX had three up days before then. It broke out from 26 to 35 as a high. And then today it got as high as 38 before the market just melted up. I mean, the plunge protection team came in strong and it dropped back down to 30. But 30 is an ominous number for the VIX to drop to after a time like that. So it's a little spicy. It's a little spicy. But I feel like crypto can breathe here for a couple of days.
Well, it's just crazy that the VIX has been chilling at 20 plus since February. You know, I mean, yeah, really, I mean, nothing's changed, like corona wise. So maybe that's why. But
we're just seeing it finally affect some of the actual legacy market price action. But I mean, if somebody is looking at this on the screen, it depends how you look at it. Like, it's a horrible bearish breakdown and a perfect all time high retest, and it saved the daily 20-day Bollinger Band midline, whatever you want to call it. Saved it to the dollar on the S&P 500, and it looks like just a wick down into the all-time high. So, I mean, it truly is it really leaves it up to what the heck happens next week. It's not really not a doji. It's like a fat body doji. What do you have a term for those on what the weekly candle on SPY does? Because it's a down candle engulfing the previous one, but there's huge wicks on both sides still. It's just not a small body.
We call it a long-legged doji, I think. Let me pull it up weekly.
I just usually think of a doji as something with a smaller body. You know, like it's still a red.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, so just a long, call it a long-legged candle, I guess.
Yeah, just a long.
In general, it just represents indecision.
Right. It still feels very indecision-like, even though it's not a proper, you know, back to where you started type of price.
It certainly doesn't look, it's not quite bearish engulfing. I guess that would be the most bearish situation, but
yeah, I don't know. It looks indecisive is the best you can say. Like, from a volume breakout perspective, Legacy was, certainly had a volume breakout yesterday. If you're peeping the volumes, there, but I don't know if I would define it as a volume breakout on the weekly or not. Anyway, it's just interesting.
Well, we talk about the VIX because it's been such a great correlation with buy the dip opportunities. So
yeah, on the highs. So if the VIX did peak yesterday and today, then it's like game on for crypto moving forward.
Right. Like, I don't want to say VIX up bearish, but VIX up will bring price down, which is a buying opportunity historically.
Yeah, the question is whether this is one of those 3 or 4 days and carry on. Well, like we had in June. I don't even remember what the price of the S&P was, but you look on the VIX there, I bet it associates with one of these Bitcoin and certainly a legacy dip, but probably Bitcoin too, you know?
Yeah, it does. And I just realized ETH tapped the key June today finally. That's really what I was waiting for. So all that talk about 10.5, 10.7 for BTC over the past couple of weeks was all about just the mean reversion situation. And yeah. BTC hit that and then some, whereas ETH didn't hit that yesterday, but hit it today. So ETH might be okay here.
Yeah, honestly. I like where Ethereum went. I think it's a really weird pattern, but... Bitcoin looks more, Ethereum just kind of went back to a level plane, like where it went to before, whereas Bitcoin broke out properly below, you know, it really basically engulfed where it broke out from on the weekly basis. And I've had, you know, we've shown the same lines on these charts for a while because price likes to go back to where it's been before. And the 10.173 is literally where it's like where we closed on yesterday's daily. And that's a weekly high level that we tested twice, and it looks like a bullish retest. Like, so if the VIX peaked, et cetera, we're good to go. If we go down another leg, we, in my opinion, we need to save like 9,200. If we get 9,200, I can't imagine how I don't just do everything I can at that level, you know?
I will be the dip at that level.
The wick or the dip?
I will be the wick, whatever.
If you'll be the dip, it means you capitulate it, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and the other part about buying dips is, for me, like, I like to buy spot with a dip. I rarely like to buy leverage with a dip unless I'm absolutely certain that there's got to be like a falling rising wedge situation or something. It's got to be a confluence of TA to tell me like, okay, this is a decent risk reward here.
Yeah, your leverage position can come from some consolidation post dip confirming versus trying to buy the knife.
Yeah, but if I would have played this on leverage, it would have been a long at 10.7, and I would be still underwater. You know? But so.
Yeah. Too much can happen below, like when something spikes due to volatility. So if we lose 9,200, the daily might say that's going to happen below 98. Basically, if we don't hold 10.2. And work our way back up towards where we already have been, like 11K, 11.5, somehow consolidate in that region. The forever 200-week, which is the old bear market moving average, that is kind of working its way towards like 7K. So that's your like OMG kind of levels. You want to see that 200-week keep moving up to keep the dream alive.
The 2-year MA is at 7,622.
Yeah. Okay. 2 years.
So
yeah,
that's my sell my organs and other people's organs level.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
Because and historically that has been the money. Anything below that.
And that's the kind of levels I only foresee that being possible personally if like legacy totally breaks down. Right.
So
not consolidation, but like I'm talking continuation bear market, then Bitcoin can do anything at that point. And I think Bitcoin will not outperform until things bottom in legacy. We're just, unfortunately, we're a little bit, Bitcoin's part of the system now, but it's also tied to some of the volatility there and not as fully independent in my mind. And I think yours as well, right?
Yeah, completely. I agree with that. And with the election stuff coming up.
Yeah, certainly a narrative for like making this all-time high action harder to come by than we want.
Yeah, but even gold wasn't safe on this move. So I see correlation. I see people saying, you know, people are saying that people have historically said that BTC is this like risk-off asset and it's like its own thing. And they point to the evidence of just like correlations like yesterday and today.
Yeah.
And then I point to evidence of like, well, look at what gold did during that time. Like there is no safe haven in certain periods of time, just anywhere, you know?
Right. One more thing on a weekly basis, 11,550-ish was our weekly close back in July 2019. We got above it and then failed it. So this is, I mean, like somebody could look at this as some kind of swing failure pattern or something from a closing basis for that. It hints to me Bitcoin probably wants to consolidate for a while. Like it doesn't look to me like, oh yeah, now Bitcoin is just going to rocket and 16K, 20K, here we come right away. Like I definitely think this could mean we're not going to do anything until we have end of the year type of moves. You know, like this could be a couple of months of dinking around. So,
yeah. Another thing about seasonality is September historically is the second worst month. I'm pretty sure on average, second or third. It's like January, March, and September are the three really bad months.
Huh.
And obviously, it's September 4th now, so we're in the thick of it.
Yeah. One other thing in terms of the hardship getting higher, above 11.5 in 2019, we really just have all weekly wicks up to 14K. And then it's like, oh, crap, all-time highs. So it's like almost like the powers that be may want a little more time for like reaccumulation or whatever you want to call it to before we push into those all-time highs. Because going to 3K, going from like 3,800 to 20K in a matter of a few months is very bubbly on its own. Rather than a healthier consolidation push.
Yeah, I agree. But it's different. Like ETH just has like this straight roller coaster rocket ship up, whereas BTC did have that consolidation period a few times now. One other thing about seasonality, Q4 is usually more bullish than Q3. Mm. So that's another thing to watch for. Speaking of end of the year stuff.
You know, I made my hyper bullish, 600 by September 25th call on ETH. And, you know, that's what you get for not waiting for the weekly close, because my weekly breakout is just like, super danger. The red box of uncertainty between 360 and like 410 is like all the way back to June 2017, all the times we danced with it. Well, we are dancing in the thick of it right now, and who knows what happens between now and Sunday, but it certainly, I mean, we could see 280. 280 is sell your kids type of environment for me. Or we could just break right above and continue on to 700. I literally have no idea what's going to happen with Ethereum here.
But the way it was going those past few days with fees and yield farming, like...
It was top things.
Yeah, but at the same time, I felt like this can just keep going. Like as long as people keep piling into ETH, I think what really killed it was the fees. It really prevented a lot of people.
It prevented people with normal budgets from participating.
Right. Exactly. It priced them out. It just squeezed everybody with a modest amount of money out of the FOMO.
Yeah.
It's like, and well, this the is train cool. stopped.
This is cool that y'all are talking about this, but this thing just cost me... $50 in, $50 out, so $100 before I do anything. So if I make a $10,000 investment, that $100 is 1% of the move, you know?
Yeah. If you compare this to the SPX weekly.
And $10,000 is not a modest investment for one trade, right? Like, that's a significant amount of money.
Yeah, I think for any normal person, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
This weekly ETH candle does look like the SPX candle, but it looks more bearish because it looks bearish engulfing to me.
Yeah, but ours hasn't closed because we don't sleep.
Yeah, and the other, well, I do, but...
You do, when we're supposed to record the podcast.
The other thing about this structure is you could argue some sort of flag situation. Anytime you have these tight candle structures like this...
Yeah.
I don't know... Like, to me, this should be continuation.
I have
in a vacuum, right?
On my chart for the daily, I've got this quasi megaphone thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was watching that as well. Higher, we got the third high.
Yeah, it's higher highs, but it's basically equal lows on a body basis, and
yeah,
maybe lower lows slightly on a wick. So to me, that signals that the bulls are buying when they're given the opportunity. And you're still making higher highs. So I think that could spell some kind of weird continuation, but it's certainly not normal from like a consolidation or pattern standpoint.
Yeah, none of this is normal. We hit We get the first. We get the head and shoulders. Then we get the failed head and shoulders. Then we get the failed head and shoulders. And now we're right back to 380. And if we break 380, then that's the level where things start to panic, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. We've held 380 since August 1st, so that's a massive level right now.
You can't talk about Ethereum without talking about the Uniswap FOMO, and not just Uniswap. I mean, that's actually that people are locking up Ethereum all over the place right now. So this also encourages these massive wicks in both directions. But just on Uniswap, you got DeFi Prime coming up. Just on Uniswap, the liquidity went from 300 million, which we thought was a ton last week, to 1.9 billion. We're about to cross $2 billion in liquidity on Uniswap. And it went from like 200 million in trading to 950 million in trading the other day, and even 550, 600 today after all that drop. So that's crazy. And there's a bunch of stable coins packaged into all that, and a ton that you could talk about for why. What do you have here for the DeFi Pulse total value locked?
I was just looking at the it's not ETH. I was looking at ETH to see if ETH came down at all, and it hasn't yet. But ETH,
the amount of ETH locked in DeFi, I think it's got to be going up, because I mean the Yearn Finance, like Y Vault, whatever they call it, it just opened up and immediately was oversubscribed. They basically had to shut it down. I am seeing there's plenty of opportunities to take relatively low risk lockups, where I've been learning a lot more about this, and you can lock up, you know, Ethereum or wrapped Bitcoin or Tether USDC, DAI, and you can use those to farm these governance tokens and crap that people are hyping up, and it locks up a ton of supply, but you're only taking two risks: spot Ethereum or Bitcoin risk if you're using one of those, and contract risk or like staking platform risk type of stuff. But that's less than if you said like, okay, well, it's this many people in an altcoin or this many people margin long. Like, and I think people are willing to take those risks because the yields are insane based on the current valuation of these tokens that are being farmed.
Yeah, the yields are definitely a siren song for people who are unable to think it through as far as the risks are concerned. And I know I say that with somebody who's not in it and felt people made a lot of money, whatever, but man, I just look at this stuff and it's so hard to get on board.
I totally, yeah. So you made the argument in a previous podcast about the DAO situation, which caused the Ethereum Classic fork.
Mm-hmm.
I see the risk of that could totally happen if any of these goes down, right? Maker, Compound, Balancer, Yearn are all huge. Aave, or however you pronounce that one. Those are massive. I don't think, I mean, Uniswap would have to be a hack in something. In Uniswap, it's more just contract, right? Like, it's just wallet to wallet. But some of these other ones, you're actually staking, or there's locking going on that you're interacting with something that's a slightly more centralized mechanism, varying degrees, but point being, I totally see it. If someone's sitting on this and saying, like, I'm going to pull the trigger at just the right time, at the same time, like, if you have that, if you're ready for that, surely this is the time, right? You know, like, there's so much money in there.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's amazing that something hasn't happened already, just because that honeypot is so big, and it's only getting bigger.
Yeah, all code has bugs. The question is, have these been tested enough? Are the contracts simple enough? Because a lot of these contracts are really simple to be able to mitigate those risks. And I am assuming at least somewhere down the line that's significant, the risks have probably not been mitigated. We'll see some big hacks or, you know, funds siphoned out or whatever else. Currently, the money is racing to this stuff, though, because the yields are enormous. I mean, when I'm looking at stuff, because I've been participating in this, you know, farming things or pooling liquidity in order to receive one of the tokens, I am seeing 50% APY, you know, earnings per year when you're compounding is APY. 50% is low. Like 80 to 100 is pretty common. It's crazy based on current valuations of those tokens. So like,
higher the better.
Well, but not
is the number even relevant? Like, is it just?
I think it is, because I think the stuff that got real crazy, and I don't understand sushi necessarily, but like sushi was a meme coin, but now they're like, it's like they're trying to undercut Uniswap, but they were offering like, I don't even know, they were just minting their token like crazy, but it was weighted towards the beginning, so that's how they did their initial distribution, and it was like 20,000% APY or something. So people just sent hundreds of millions of dollars there, and the token itself went up as well. So that was super fascinating, because money flocked to it, despite it being obvious how many coins were being printed. It didn't stop it from going from 70 cents at the bottom to over $11 at the top over the course of like 2 days. And this thing's going to continue printing like crazy, but it's still worth $4.60. So, yeah.
Is it worth $4.60, or can you sell a token for $4.60?
That's a great question. And I would say,
I don't think it's worth anything, but I think you can sell it.
But Josh, the liquidity is there. There's $92 million of liquidity on Uniswap.
You can, for sushi. You can sell it and make the money back, but is it worth anything?
I would say yes, because you can sell it. I can sell it for Ethereum right now. I can sell a lot of it. On the sushi ETH pair, there's $182 million of liquidity. So let's talk about how much
sushi. My question is more philosophical than
but mine is practical, and I want to get to a tweet thread that I wrote about it.
Oh, man.
Uh-huh. I can sell 10,000 Ethereum. How much money is that? $40 million or something?
Sure.
That's $4 million. I can sell $4 million of sushi and have a 4% price impact on a DEX. So that's liquidity, man. That is liquidity.
It's liquidity right now. Liquidity begets liquidity. And we've talked about the regulatory stuff.
It can dry quickly. You see it moving around on these different pools.
Yeah.
And yeah.
There's a ton of stablecoin sloshing around right now on Huobi, Binance, FTX. There's a ton of very large holders moving BTC around and moving ETH around, getting these yields. So I think it's ripe for something to happen, because anytime, one, it's too good to be true, and two, we've seen this all before. It's bound to happen again, where nobody remembers what happened with the DAO. And something's going to happen. Well, I don't want to be the doomer gloomer guy, but man,
I think the easy answer is what I just drew on my screen, which is coins like sushi just have a trajectory towards zero because they bleed from the inflation that starts to play out.
Yeah.
I did a thread. I'm going to read my own tweet threads. I know that sounds boring, but it was this concept we've talked about with zombie tokens and liquidity and the value of this stuff. Cause my buddy Gainsey was like, I'm making so much money farming, but I don't even understand why. Like if I'm making $1,000 an hour, who's losing $1,000 an hour? Yeah. And it makes sense in principle, but the answer is no one is losing $1,000 an hour because this is money that's being created out of thin air. So the thread was about talking about money and how money is created, because money is created out of thin air, even in particularly in the legacy markets. Most money is created through the issuance of debt, right? The bank just has to have some small margin of capital to be able to loan you money. You get real money that you can spend. So that is creation of money. In crypto, the way that's done is newly minted coins that are valued based on a very small minority of the total supply that actually change hands for under a base pair like Ethereum or Bitcoin. That establishes the price, even though it's not truly the value. So in a bull market, that enables expansion, and then without those new inflows of fiat or Bitcoin or Ethereum that moves into them, those coins will start to contract and money will essentially leave the system, liquidity will leave the system. Those coins become zombies, like remember when Ripple went up to $3 and those guys were the richest people in the world for like a day, but they literally never could have sold it because there was not near enough liquidity to handle it. So all that climaxes and then it all goes down and, you know, goes to crap. And the contraction cycle begins, money goes away. That's when people truly lose, because the people who were bringing in that fresh Ethereum, fiat, whatever else, their true valuation goes down, nor can they sell it, and they're the ones that lose money. But to say it isn't real money now while it's liquid, I don't think it's true. I think it is real money for the people that get out before it becomes illiquid.
Right. Would you say it's like an inverse Ponzi or a reverse Ponzi?
I don't know. I mean, we use the word Ponzi pretty
well. Ponzi broadly is using new money to pay for outrageous returns for people, sure, that are in first, right?
If it's a Ponzi, I think it's a more extreme example of what already exists in other markets, right? There's plenty of stocks where if someone came in and tried to sell 20% of the stock in one go, they'd send the stock to zero. There's just not enough bidders. There's not enough people willing to take it when that much is going out. And that's what creates stairs up, elevator down, right? Because the elevator is, once nobody wants to buy it at that price, then it's game over. And it has to keep going down continuously until somebody steps in. So I think it's the same as any market. And I mean, what I just described about money is, I learned it from Ray Dalio, you know?
Yeah.
It's in his book, Big Debt Cycles, which is an absolutely terrific read. And it talks about where money comes from. But that's where these massive drawdowns come, is because when the news hits that takes everything that you know and takes it away, then the number has to go down, and it can go down really, really quickly. And that's how money leaves the system.
So let me try to sum it up.
Yeah.
Because I'm still trying to wrap my head around this. So I make a yield farming contract.
Mm-hmm.
I promise returns based on printing the token.
Yes.
Minting the token. And those returns go up if more people get in? Is that right?
No. It's okay, so let's use sushi as an example. And I haven't actually done the sushi one, but if you want, I'm going to use Balancer as a better example. All right, it's a different one. And actually, Balancer manages a lot of these pools and stuff. It's just like Uniswap though, except Balancer has their own token as well that they're using to help incentivize. So if there's a pool, let's say, you hear my kids.
Yeah, it's okay.
If there's a pool, like the Ethereum Balancer pool, someone buying and selling is doing so through that pool. And the overall amount of liquidity in that pool makes it so that you can purchase a lot of it without a lot of slippage. The impermanent loss that occurs because you're never getting a perfect price when people are doing that. I did have some videos on this on YouTube. If none of this is making sense, I go into more detail there. But it's not a perfect calculation for the buyers and the sellers in this pooling system, but that's it works from an infinite pool. There's not like an order book is scaled like a pyramid, right, or an inverse pyramid. So you say you're okay selling Bitcoin at $12,000. I say I'm okay selling Bitcoin at $14,000. That's the scale. In a pool, everybody's just on both sides, and the automated market makers kind of doing the work of keeping the two pools level. Well, at its basis, buying and selling using that model is not a very efficient thing for the people who decided to pool. But this, having the people in the pool providing the liquidity, is what enables interest in the token, because it's liquid. Liquid tokens are good. So what these protocols or coins are doing, so Balancer, they are rewarding Balancer for people using Balancer pools. So just to promote their own ecosystem, some of their inflation goes towards people participating in creating Balancer pools, just like Uniswap pools. In addition to that, a token, let's say, I know there's some out there, but let's say like MTA, the MTA token is also rewarding people who are providing liquidity for MTA. So it's instead of paying a market maker on an exchange and a centralized exchange listing, you're paying the holders of your token to then provide liquidity, to take the extra step of pooling those tokens. So that's where it comes from. The question is, in to what degree is that inflation set up? What yield are they earning? What other things can they do? So like, you may have a choice in the governance of the ecosystem because you've pooled tokens as well, like other stuff that you get, and therefore you aren't doing more to earn power as a voice. So it's, in my opinion, it's actually a more sophisticated version of what traditional staking was. You know, like you talked about, how staking is just staking. Like, who cares? What do you get? What's the point? Well, in this setup, you're actually providing liquidity for the buying and selling of the token, which is necessary to participate in the whole thing. I think it's more elegant. I can get behind that. What I can't get behind is the sushi was the goof, you know, the first one, but then there was a bunch of scams purely based on the, you know, what the stated APY was that people were chasing. And then some of them, you know, people can like literally pull all the liquidity out at once by minting a bunch of their token, whatever else. And they, you know, they scam people out of all their money. In a perfect world of how these can be designed, I think some of this is really fascinating, how, you know, you can provide rules for how you lend or borrow using crypto or stablecoins as collateral. There's a lot of stuff like that. That's the part of DeFi that I've come around to and really can appreciate. I think all of this is very much in the alpha stages in terms of what's the right formula for things, and I think that's where some of the governance stuff is coming in as well, right? So as these token holders kind of make the decisions about what's the right way to provide these incentives and structure all this stuff.
Yeah, it's funny, we keep having all these iterations on governance, because at the end of the day, staking isn't only consensus, but it was this promise of governance. But yeah, the issue with that was always one or two entities just controlling most of the network, and they would just do whatever they wanted with the governance, right?
Yeah, and all you were really doing was chasing, like, staking, you know?
Yeah, and isn't that what Sam is doing at it from FTX with Sushi? Like, didn't he just...
Yeah, like, he just sent a ton of money there and farmed a crap load of it and probably dumped it all over people.
But, like, because of that, he was able to puts forward some proposals or something. I don't know all the details.
I think he must have. I don't know enough about Sushi in particular, but like, there, every food coin, just name a food and it's been one.
That's just another example of, you know, it's an example of the real world where the richest person or the richest people decide governance. we're not getting past what's already happening in existing,
right? And
governance, you know,
and what we're seeing too is people are chasing yield. And it's a dual incentive, right? I want, like, here's one that's 80% Balancer, 20% Ethereum. So Balancer's claim to fame is actually non-equal weighted pools. So you can have like 80% of one token and 20% of one token. So the mandate's just keeping the 80-20, not the 50-50, whereas Uniswap and Mooniswap and others are all 50-50. But, you know, you have a list of these stuff and it's like, oh, well, I can earn 200% APY on this one. And this one's only 40%. This one's 27%. So this is kind of establishing the speculation around where can I get the best APY and blend that with maybe where can I have a successful trade just by, you know, holding Balancer or some other token itself. So that's simultaneously what's interesting about it and what's probably going to become less and less lucrative as some of these yields start to go down naturally, right?
Yeah, I think the minting thing, you know, it all looks attractive until people who haven't been selling start selling.
Yeah.
I don't know what goes through the mind of someone who's yield farming, but if it was me, I'd say, okay, I'm getting this, they're minting this token for me out of thin air and everyone else. I'm going to just dump this as quickly as humanly possible because I don't think it's going to hold value.
I had a friend who, he started minting one of the ones that was promising this absurd, you know, return, to where mm-hmm. he was essentially minting the entire value of what he deposited like every hour. So he, every hour he would do a withdrawal to take out the stuff he'd minted, sell it, and then keep minting with the original. And he was able to earn like five times the amount that he deposited over the course of a night while this thing was getting hyped up by Arthur from BitMEX on Twitter and like all these other people. And then when it looked like the price was starting to feel the weight of all these people selling, he just took out the deposit and peaced out.
Right. So that part of it is very Ponzi-like, right?
Very Ponzi-like, and that's the part that'll go away.
Well, hopefully, but you're using new deposits to pay for returns, right?
Yeah, and then eventually the last people just don't have anything of much value because it was printed to infinity by the time they got there.
But they still have their initial capital, right?
Yeah, they have their sushi now, or they have whatever they pooled it with. Like if they had to pool to do it, they have the other 50% of.
So they're not losing all their money. They're just losing the yield, essentially.
I'm not saying you're losing all your money. You just lost the 50% that was in sushi.
You know, I'm trying to put this in a box, and I realize it's not possible. It's just to help me understand what the hell's going on here.
Yeah, it's crazy for sure. But I think what we're seeing is it's kind of the wild west of people taking an idea that someone created in like maybe a more purist sense, right?
It's almost like disrupting market making.
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in because I think it's disrupting market making. I think as a holder of a token, I'm now given the power of providing and earning from the liquidity because I'm also earning the fees, right? Yeah. So it's if someone is trading on one of the platforms, I was doing this on Muniswap. So let's look at DIA. So it had X number and it's gone way down. This can change rapidly, but it had up to 600,000 in fee in liquidity, but it had like I don't know $50,000 in fees or something one day, and the people providing the liquidity are who earned those fees. So you literally can make money by being a hodler and participating in the provision of liquidity and earning the fees that go through the ecosystem. I think it's truly part of the answer for making DEXs the real deal and being advantageous versus centralized platforms where the market maker is winning on that stuff. And if they can get the mix right of the liquidity, the fee earning back to the people providing the liquidity, and maybe some kind of like cherry on top through one of these governance tokens or whatever with a more responsible inflation rate that you earn that has value and voting power – I think that is actually a really, really interesting mix. I just think the rewards will come way down as, you know, things like start to get figured out.
Right. It'll just be what's the next thing that provides a bigger yield, right? Like right now, this is providing an insane yield. But whatever the next iteration of this is, we'll just suck liquidity to that, you know, like a vacuum vortex.
Yeah, people will keep chasing it. And meanwhile, though, we're seeing Ethereum lock up and all this. That's where this started. And we've seen the Ethereum price escalate because of it. What I think we'll start to see is Ethereum will have wild swings in both directions as the you know, some coins are just locked in the pools. It both allows the price to move less when people buy and sell, but at the same time, it locks so much in that it kind of forces the price to be stronger in each direction. So I think we're going to learn a lot about what effect it has on the underlying price, but I do think it's going to have an underlying effect on Ethereum and potentially Bitcoin as Bitcoin decentralized, you know, DEX swaps start to occur. Right now that's through wrapping your Bitcoin and using like RIN BTC or WBTC or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, ZRX is basically done everything these other DEXs are doing as far as like the market making stuff, because you stake your ZRX, you get paid out in ETH. So there's a lot of entities trying to do what this Uniswap stuff is trying
to do. When ZRX built this stuff out, though, they tried, and this is what IDEX had to, they had books, order books. They didn't have liquidity pools. And I think that is maybe the thing that caught on the most.
Yeah, I mean, I just did an article on them this week, I think, but they released Matcha. I don't know if you've used it or heard of it, but
I have heard of it. I talked to them about it.
It very simple, no order book, buy and sell, 30 tokens I think they have on there. But that's it, it's all like, all this is converging to the same type of system where there's no order book anymore. You just buy and sell at whatever price, and it's sort of seamless integration into a wallet.
Yeah. And I think it, I think it's good on the whole, like, especially if the fees can be managed. Right now, Ethereum can't handle it. You know, they had 3 years of being able to figure it out. And is there an over under pool? I think one of the Augur pools or one of them is like, is Ethereum 2.0 going to launch in 2020? And then there's got to be another one of like, is the whole network going to fail due to it? You know.
Well, stuff like this helps the launch happen quicker because necessity is the mother of invention. So
yeah, they're desperate for it.
Yeah, it's do or die. Like, put up or shut up. Like, let's get this stuff on the road, right? Like,
that's right.
It's time to see what she's made of.
Yeah, for sure. All right, you have another chart on your. We'll talk about Tezos for a minute, and then we'll finalize with where we think we're going BTC ETH-wise.
Yeah, I've just been watching Tezos and Link a lot, just mainly because people are asking about it. But I'm also a proud Tezos holder.
Nice. Okay, and we're going to have to talk about one more, too, because if you're shilling your bag, I'm going to shill mine.
I'm not shilling it. I'm just saying, like, people are asking me about it. I'm concerned. It's my position, certainly. But
yeah, it looks like a big old distribution to me, just saying.
Yeah, Tezos BTC looks done to me. Link USD looks done to me. It needs to go. It still needs to go down further, I think, to 10 or just stay sideways.
The other thing about Link USD, 50% drawdown. I mean, it went to 20 for a hot minute.
Yeah, yeah. But what does that mean, though? Really,
$20 Link was $20,000 Bitcoin.
$20 Link is like $3 Ripple to me. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, this moving average thing, moving average multiplier, also says it's done.
It said so, it was the top.
Yeah, so it's Link and Tezos. They don't look great, certainly. My argument for Tezos is that it hasn't moved whatever percentage this is. What is this, 4,000% or something?
Yeah, ridiculous.
1,000, whatever. You know, it hasn't moved 1,000%, so maybe it'll do something.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Okay, so if you shield your bag, I'm going to shield mine. BZRX, this is another, in the same vein of, you know, all these other ones, but it's actually taking the decentralized trading model and applying margin to it. This is the one that we made fun of a couple months ago about having the flash loan hack. So they did a whole bunch of audit and work, and they just opened it back up. But it's a non-custodial, no KYC, fully tokenized trading thing for margin trading. And for me, you say things like no KYC and non-custodial, that's what I want in margin trading. So if it can actually work, then that's pretty exciting to me. Anyway, this thing pumped like crazy as it got some exchange listings and finally broke out of what it was doing. And I've been buying the crap out of it on this gigantic drop that it had. So I'm interested in the product. I'm bullish on the price because it also retested its Ethereum all-time high. It's just, it looks insane to me from a price perspective. So I think it chilled out after it got listed on Binance and all that crap. And now we'll see if they can continue with their hype for what they're trying to provide from a product perspective. Now they can sponsor the podcast if they want to. After saying all these nice things, and I own their token.
ETH and BZRX and a lot of these tokens are great examples of an Eiffel Tower pattern where you just get this massive V.
Just retrace the entire breakout.
Yep, you go straight up, straight down, elevator up, elevator down.
Well, I bought it when the elevator came back down, so we'll see. I played it on the way up too some, but I didn't catch that whole move.
So really what I'm watching for is, will ETH keep leading BTC? Because if it does, and ETH is unsuccessful in holding 380,
it'll tell us what's next.
BTC should break 10K pretty easily if ETH can't hold 380. That's really what it comes down to.
Well, we are rooting against that, Mr. Olson.
Certainly.
I want numbers.
I mean, there's a dragonfly on the daily right now. Like,
yeah, it looks good.
It's just this weird megaphone thing. I don't know. I'd have to look up.
Yeah, when Legacy bought the dip this afternoon, it gave me confidence, honestly, at least until Sunday night futures open up. Like, we could totally open up Sunday night and limit down and start that whole rodeo again in Legacy. I don't think we will. I think Legacy will probably consolidate, which gives crypto room to kind of operate in its own world and get outside as much of the influence of Legacy. That's my hope.
And Orange Man was talking about stimulus a few minutes ago. I don't know if you saw
him. Man. Orange Man sees down day on stocks. Orange Man talks stimulus. It's like
he was talking jobs and stimulus. So.
He knows how to speak to the people at the basis level.
I guess so. My reptilian brain really paid attention.
All right, man. Let's leave it there. It's great talking to you. We'll catch everybody next time. Hey, thank you all for joining us on this episode. Check out our next stream on Twitch, our YouTube videos. Both Josh and I have been doing a lot. Rate us on iTunes. We'll talk to you next time. Later. In the blink of an eye, the easy river has just run dry. In a house of cards, I feel the breeze wound so tight, I can barely breathe.